Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is November 12th, 2018. And today, we are going to be discussing my favorite topic, which is energy, and even better, we're going to be doing it with an expert and very importantly, in the context of all three E's, the economy, energy, and the environment. Now, many people rightly understand that we have to and that we're going to move back to a largely solar and alternative energy-based economy. But I would guess, in my estimation, roughly the same number of people badly underestimate the effort that's going to take. Time, scale, and cost, all three elements are going to be enormous in our quest to move away from fossil fuels and onto what is almost certain to be a little bit more costly, maybe a lot more costly, and complicated set of interconnected alternative energy systems. But what really are the considerations and the challenges? Do you know? Does anybody? Well, the answer to that last question is yes. And today with us is a true energy expert recommended by quite a few of our listeners. So I am pleased to welcome Dr. Scott Tinker to the show. Dr. Tinker is the director of the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin. He has served as president of the American Geosciences Institute, the Association of American State Geologists, the American Association of Petroleum Geologists, and the Gulf Coast Association of Geological Societies. Scott Tinker co-produced and is featured in the award-winning energy documentary film Switch, which has been screened in over 50 countries to more than 15 million viewers and is used on thousands of K-12 and college campuses. Dr. Tinker formed the 501c3 Switch Energy Alliance and is working on two new films addressing global energy poverty and the energy transition. Without further ado, Scott, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Chris. It's nice to be here.
Well, Scott, I am personally thrilled to have you on the program because energy is the issue of our times, as far as I'm concerned. My background, just so you know, includes a PhD in biological sciences, so I fully understand the importance of energy to organisms. Scott, in your view, how transformational has the discovery and use of fossil fuels been to the human species?
Well, humans go back a ways.
Yeah.
In our distant and not so distant past, we're using carbon-based fuels, of course, wood for heating and cooking, and when we got fire, and hay to feed our engines, which are horses and mules and oxen. So carbon-based fuels have been used as long as humans have been around. And most recently, you know, if you look at the last 100 years, let's say, or even go back to when oil was first discovered in 1859 in Titusville, Pennsylvania, in the U.S., humans have begun to use fossil fuels and coal before that. So there's been this interesting transition from carbon, wood and hay, and coal, which is largely carbon with some impurities, to hydrocarbons, some hydrogen thrown in there in complex hydrocarbon chains, and then more recently to natural gas, which is really a hydrogen fuel, four hydrogens and just one carbon in every atom, not hydrogen by weight, but certainly by element. And so if you look at that transition, that decarbonization, if you will, even of the fossil fuel mix, it's been an important one. The upside to having the fossil energy is that nature did what humans are trying to do, which has made the energy very dense. So solid forms, liquid forms, and energy terms, natural gas is a very dense form of energy by weight. So nature did that, and it has allowed the countries in the world that have become wealthy, like ours, and others that have grown to build their economies on energy and largely fossil energy. It hasn't happened across the world yet, but that's a different part of the story.
So in the way that I look at this, you know, I have all these charts about economic growth and population growth and all these other things. And when you overlay the charts, they pretty well stack up. The explosion in human population easily can be tied to the use of fossil fuels in agriculture, in the production distribution, all of that, and fertilizers. But as well, our whole economic engine, Scott, the best economic chart I've got, because it's got the tightest linear regression and there's no deviation in it, is charting energy used to economic output across the globe. You know, you can't just, because people import energy and hide it in their statistics. But when I look at this, to me, one of the tightest relationships we have is economic growth and use of energy. Those two pieces seem to come together. I found a video that you produced in 2009 with a title of Energy, Environment, and the Economy, connecting those three broad areas. How do you connect those, in your own words?
Oh, boy. You know, it's complicated.
Of course.
You wrap those up with sort of policy and legal and social aspects, and you can't underestimate the complexity, because it impacts all of us, from those who have no energy to those who do. I lovingly call that intersection of the three E's the radical middle, and have written about that and tried to play there myself. The radical middle is that space where you come away from your area. Maybe it's jobs and economics. Maybe it's energy and secure energy. Maybe it's the environment and protecting not just the atmosphere, but the water and the land systems. But if you come to that middle, you're going to have to compromise quite a bit and look hard at data and realize you're not always going to be right. But it's a great place to struggle and interact with multi-disciplines and multi-perspectives to actually try to tackle some of these big challenges in a way that might move us forward, as opposed to staying outside of that. The further you get, the better it may feel, but probably the less likely that you're going to have that real opportunity to work closely and try to advance things. So I define them as the radical middle, and they do engage both the economic components that you've described, Chris, as well as all the way down to the 1.1 billion people in the world without electricity and the 2.7 billion people without clean cooking, living in various stages of energy poverty. They engage the spectrum of energy and, of course, the environmental impacts that all forms of energy have, renewable and otherwise, you know, fossil, nuclear, renewable, at scale. They all have major environmental impacts.
Well, that's a fascinating topic to get onto. And, you know, just by way of setting the stage just a bit further, Scott, my main work in the world, if I could put it in some respects, is simply it's a continuation of Dr. Albert Bartlett's educational outreach on exponential growth. And my view, very firmly held still, is that perpetual exponential growth on a finite planet is just neither possible mathematically nor really a good idea. And it feels to me like we're at that moment where we're going to have to transition away from a couple of big models, energy and energy use around fossil fuels, as well as this growth model. Now, when you're talking about an energy transition, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm presuming you're talking about not simply a continuation of the human industrial experiment as it's been right along its exponential path, you know, by some other means. Do I have that right? Or, what are we really talking about? We're talking about an energy transition. Is it to a very different future, or is it to really a different way of running the current way we understand things?
Well, both and neither. In my view, exponential growth of population is unsustainable, but I think we've already started to go linear. When economies get educated and access to energy and modernized, growth rates, birth rates go way down. So you've seen that in modern economies. In fact, birth rates are negative in some of the more modern ones, other than the people that come in through immigration, or importing people. Now, in some of the countries that have not grown industrialized yet, for example, Africa is projected to double in population in this century, from 1 to 2 billion people plus or minus, and that's really rapid growth. So I think that one tends to take care of the other, it tends to be a bit of a chicken and egg conversation. Nothing grows exponentially forever in resource terms. You know, that you see forecasts all the time that get a little jolly on their forecast when you start early in something. If it starts to succeed, you see exponential growth because adding that next doubling unit, if you will, takes a bit of stuff. But each year that goes by, it takes a lot more stuff to grow exponentially. You see that in electric vehicles. They went from exponential growth in 13, 14, 15 to linear, arguably, in 16 and 17. And already starting to go linear, and then we'll roll over because it just takes more stuff to continue to add that next increment. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that exponential growth is how I would describe the systems we're in, and therefore I don't know that they're unsustainable. I think what it does take is energy, and for the modern world, and we would like to see everyone in the world have access to those opportunities. I was in Nepal 2 weeks ago, heading to Ethiopia next week, looking at energy poverty and some of the challenges there. It's arguably wrong. Put whatever terms you want on it. Some say morally wrong, some say ethically wrong, some say economically wrong. Some say it's just not a good idea because of the increased diversity and expansion of disparity between those who have and those who don't. Whatever component or combination of those things you believe, I think most would say that helping to lift a third of the world out of energy poverty will do a lot of good things for the world, and it's not just food and clothing and shelter. It's things like immigration, where you have opportunity at home, you don't need to immigrate. You can start to read and educate your families and kids. The rights, freedom, and empowerment of women are much improved when you begin to have access to more modern systems, where you're not cooking with wood inside or walking miles to a river for dirty water, et cetera. So I think the conversation about energy is critical. We need to really think about, and again, at scale, all forms of energy have environmental impact. So what we need to think about is what we want to accomplish with the energy, including environmentally, land, air, and sea, not judge the energy types, but look at how we go about making those energy sources sustainable environmentally, and they all can be.
Well, let's talk about those let's talk now about that sustainability. And I'm really interested in the work of Vaclav Smil, who I'm sure you're familiar with, and looking at these energy transitions. They take a lot of time, particularly if you're allowing market forces, and particularly if you note more subtly that often when we make an energy transition, historically, we were moving from, let's say, a worse, to put a declarative term on it, but we're moving from a more diffuse to a more concentrated energy source. Before we get into these alternative energies, let's set the stage. Where are we in this fossil fuel story? Are we closer to the beginning or the end?
It depends. On a resource basis, we're not near the end. You know, there's coal, hundreds of years. There's oil, hundreds of years. And there's natural gas, probably hundreds and hundreds of years. Even at current consumption and growing consumption rates with growing economies in a resource. And let me define that as a geologist, a resource, and all of us, is what's down there, what's in place in the earth. Converting that to a economic reserve is what energy companies go about doing. So through from a resource to a reserve to something they can produce. And we've seen different times when oil looked like it was peaking and running out, but what was peaking and running out was the oil in certain kinds of reservoirs. Technology advances always more quickly than we think it will, always. And it's created access to oil in different kinds of reservoirs. It's not unconventional oil. It's the same oil. It's different kinds of rock systems that can now be produced with new technology. Same with natural gas. And natural gas is locked up in places that are currently uneconomic, but in massive amounts. And I'm not just talking about in shale, but locked up in ice systems called clathrates or hydrates, even potentially abiogenic gases. So it's not methane and other kinds of gases are abundant. And it's not really a limit to the resource in the terms that we think about. It's whether or not something comes along, and I'm a big fan of Vaclav Smil and Jesse Ossebel and others who have looked at decarbonization, but whether or not something comes along that is better. And by better, I'm going to do that in terms of energy density and economics. Is there something that is more useful than what we currently have? If and as that happens, then we transition to that. Sometimes the economics of something goes in a way that the price becomes too high, basic supply and demand and other things, and we find technologies to get options to that. And there are many examples of that through time. So I don't think we're limited right now in fossil energy by the resource. There's certainly, it's tough to replace because of its density and the systems in place, the infrastructure in place, both on the transportation side and the power generation side, they take time. It just takes time to change technologies, even if and when something better comes along. So I tend to look more at what do we do to make sure the energy that we're using and have access to, which is doing a lot of good things for the world in terms of economics and poverty and human advancement, can be made more sustainable.
Let's talk about that one piece you just brought up, the time. What is the typical time involved in moving something from, let's say we found something, higher energy density, economics are good, but it's not currently operating at scale. In fact, it's just something we've discovered, or it's still really at the pilot stage. What's the time involved here?
Yeah, it depends on the system. But I mean, let's do vehicles. Let's pretend like you had a battery the size of your cell phone. It doesn't exist. I want to be real clear.
Okay, thank you.
Let's say we had a battery the size of our cell phone that we could charge in 3 minutes, like we do filling up with gasoline in a car or CNG or something. You could charge it in 3 minutes and easily put it into your car and run for 350 miles. And it was free. Let's pretend like the energy was free. So that's a lot of good stuff that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. But even if it did, the perfect battery, free charging, 3 minutes, run for 350 miles, it would take decades to transition half the world's vehicle fleet. And that's just because there's 1.2 billion vehicles on the road, mostly running on gasoline and diesel. And my new magic battery in that car would be great, but somebody would probably buy my gasoline car because it would be cheaper, not in demand as much, and it would stay on the road for 10 or 20 years or more. Vehicles tend to last a long time. So, and how about coal plants? Coal plants last 50, 60, 70 years or more. Asia has built a lot of new ones in the last decade. Probably not going to shut them down, even as other options come on. China's building 29 new nuclear reactors today, and the largest hydro facility in the world is in China, Three Gorges, and importing LNG and wind and solar. But those coal plants underpin that economy coming out of poverty. Mm-hmm. And so are they going to shut those down? Highly unlikely. In a long time, for decades. So that how do you then say, well, let's make coal much more environmentally sustainable, not just its emissions, yes, to be sure, SOx, NOx, mercury, particulates, and even CO2, but also the mining of it, the transportation of it. How do we make this better so that our goal, which is the environmental sustainability, is achieved without putting a good or a bad qualifier on the source of energy, or believer or denier religious terms on people who talk about different energy options?
Well, let's see. You use the word clean and coal in roughly the same sentence. How do you put those two words together? What's possible here?
Well, clean to me is a environmental breadth. So it includes removing the particulates from the combustion source, particulates, SOx, NOx, mercury. Mm-hmm. Those make, that's what impacts the local air and local air emissions and air quality. Most modern coal plants have unit scrubbers that scrub a lot of that out, including the ones in China and the U.S. It's an energy penalty, so it makes it more expensive. You have to use more coal to run it, mm-hmm. but that makes it more expensive, and that puts that prices it competitively more into the market to make it clean. CO2 emissions from coal are very real as well. To scrub those out is another unit, whether it's post-combustion or pre-combustion, integrated gasification combined cycle power plants, which aren't, they're not that many of them, or a post-combustion, or post-combustion scrubbing. And we're doing the first real commercial scale one of those in Texas on the Parrish Power Plant right now, scrubbing it out and then putting it somewhere, in this case, an oil field and into saltwater brines for overflow. So that's called carbon capture and storage or sequestration, CCS. Again, adds an energy penalty and a cost penalty if the CO2 coming out of the stream has the value, is valuable enough to remove it that way, then you put that on it. That's just on the combustion end. On clean on the mining end, you know, are you open mines where we have a lot of those in the U.S. and other places in the world where they literally backfill them with the same volume that was removed, contour the land and plant them with natives. It's up in the Powder River Basin, for example, in South Dakota. The land where they have mined is actually formed and planted with more native than the direction they're currently mining, which has had the more recent century of impacts to it. Or are you removing mountaintops, you know, or are you in subsurface mining with unsafe practices to humans? So that's not sustainable. There are other mining practices for coal which are more sustainable. And again, I think probably maybe somebody just threw a shoe at the radio or wherever they're listening, because I'm talking about coal and cleaning it up, and some people might believe that coal is the worst thing in the world. It needs to be cleaned up, and it costs energy and money to do that, but it can be done and is being done in many places. So, you know, the upsides to coal, again, are that every major economy in the world has built their electric economy around it. We're transitioning away from it in the U.S. China is just starting to do that. But you can't go to China and look at the people that have come out of poverty in the last three decades and say you shouldn't have done that. Yeah, that's a judgment call that I don't think anyone has a right to make. And you have to then offer equally scaled and sustainable sources of electricity, including affordable, available, reliable, and sustainable alternatives if you're going to not use coal. And I think there's probably a good case study would be India. What's India going to do? You know, it has a lot of people, and many of them don't have much energy or any at all. What are they going to do to provide electricity, for example, to 600 or 700 million people in India out of the 1.x billion? How are they going to do that? And it's a very important conversation. And they could be the first economy to do it without coal. They've got coal, but they could look toward other options to go to large-scale electricity generation in India and maybe skip that coal step, which the rest of us have done.
And those options for India, including, obviously, they're going pretty full force on solar. Do they have hydro or geothermal, or what would their other options be to leapfrog the coal step?
Yeah, the only two really are nuclear and natural gas. Mm-hmm. Solar won't do it. Wind won't do it. And hydro won't do it in India. They don't have the topography or the rainfall, whereas a place like, you know, if you go down to South America, lots of countries in South America have topography, rainfall, and are building dams. Their demand is much lower, number of people and economic demand is much lower. And places like Norway, of course, have built their whole economy on hydro. So that's great. But again, you have to have the right resource for topography and rainfall. India does not. You have to have a fuel that can be always on as you grow your economy. The demand for electricity is 24/7, 365 in developed economies. I mean, we're spoiled by it, but if you look at the hurricane that just came across Florida, and I was just reading an article on the two-week outage there in the Panhandle and what folks went through there without any electricity for 2 weeks. You have to have something always on. In Texas, we have more wind than any other state in the nation, times three. We have about 23 gigawatts of nameplate capacity. It doesn't generate that much, of course. Capacity factor is around 30% now for wind. But you have to back all that up with something when the wind's not blowing, which happens every day in Texas. It's windy and it's not windy at a certain time. And so we have redundant natural gas plants to load follow, coal and nuclear to base load with, and some storage. We can talk about storage as a separate topic if there's time, but you know, to really truly build that kind of engine, economic engine, takes one of those three: nuclear, natural gas, coal, and some combination, or hydro if you have access to that. Expanded solar is great and wind is great. It's just intermittent daily. I mean, you know, in most places in the world, there's a thing called night, you mm-hmm. know, and rainy days and cloudy days. Some places in the world have terrible solar intensity. Others have very poor wind resource. Some have good wind. Some have great solar, low latitude, lots of sunny days like the Southwest U.S., et cetera. So, but you still have to have something there, some combination of storage and optional generation to partner with the wind and the sun. Or some people would argue, well, you could, if you build enough wind and enough sun, somewhere it's windy, somewhere it's sunny. That's a good theoretical conversation to have and would be true. But in a practical sense, it's very difficult to get a integrated network, electric grid network of that scale. And if there are times when it's a big storm for a week or not a big calm period, which happen, then you're really going down a road of limited optionality. So, you know, I think most people who study these things intensively would say you got to partner some things with other things, and they all add value in the right way and at the right scale.
Now, would it be, Scott, wrong of me to sort of simplify all of this in a way by saying that the fossil fuels represented sort of easy, right, to just park a coal plant in, which we did a number of decades ago, and you don't worry really about the mercury or the NOx or the SOx or any of the stuff coming out of the stack, and you just park it there. That's easy compared to saying, well, now we're going to have to do some complex balancing of you know, we're going to have natural gas, coal, nuclear, maybe some hydro if we've got it. Then we're going to stack wind and solar on there as, you know, for when they're operating, we can use them. And then we have to have some kind of on-demand base generation that can kick in. These are much more complex systems we're talking about here. Is that an inaccurate sort of characterization? The energy future is going to be more complex than the past.
On the electricity system, I think that's a good characterization, Chris. You know, If easy was a single source and complex is multiple, fair, very fair. On the other hand, portfolios of things are more secure. Whether it's mm-hmm. stocks or real estate or energy, if I have a portfolio of options available to me, I'm really better off in the long run because some of those are going to be good working and some of those are going to be expensive at times and not at other times. So it's good to have that kind of, again, optionality in an electric system, if you will. So I like the idea of renewables coming in for sure. I like the idea of geothermal in places coming in and certainly natural gas, coal, and nuclear, hydro mixed in. It's nice to have those options if they're available to you. You can't judge places that don't have all those resources. And every one of those, by the way, is a resource. uranium and thorium, coal, the ones we understand, but the sun and the wind, tides and waves, they're all resources, geothermal. So it the more resources you have at your disposal within some geographically reasonable range, the better. But you're absolutely right. It's a more complex system to manage in terms of a grid. And it does give you a neat opportunity, though, you know, the time of day pricing, the smarter grids and smarter meters, the things that artificial intelligence and data analytics are going to allow us to do as we move forward to make those systems more efficient. I'm excited by that. I think it's a direction that we need to go, we will go, and hopefully the world can accelerate as they follow the lead of the bigger economies. I like getting away from just coal in electricity and just oil in transportation. I think it makes great sense.
I would agree with that. And you've mentioned a number of magic words to me here, which I want to get to, storage being one, thorium being another. Very rare to hear that come up in conversation, but I'm pretty intrigued by it myself. I want to, though, there's a seminal concept that a lot of my listeners and myself are really quite taken with based on the work of Charlie Hall and the other people who've really progressed the idea of energy return on energy invested. It makes a lot of sense to me, particularly as one from a biological science background. You know, organisms thrive when they have a surplus of energy that comes in versus expended. As I look, I heard you say hundreds of years of oil. Scott, I got to be honest, when I look at the oil fields, you know, I can't compare the Ghawar field and a single pipe that went vertically 1,100 feet down that churned out 3,000 barrels a day for 50 years. I can't compare that to an Eagleford well that's, you know, churning out, you know, maybe it's 8, 9, 10, 12, 13, 14,000 feet total and is going to produce maybe a few 100,000 barrels total across its life. The energy return on that feels poor. How does energy return on energy invested factor into your thinking, your work?
Yeah, again, those are fair descriptions of the Ghawar field and the Eagle Ford. I think that what they probably, let me add to that a little bit. The oil that was found at Ghawar, sometimes called Easy Oil. Look, my dad was a geologist and in the energy business in the 50s and 60s. And he says, "Hey, Scott, that wasn't easy. We had crappy old data and, you know, no seismic, and it was hard to find. It was just easy to produce once we found it." And so the Eagle Ford, on the other hand, is not that hard to find. We know where the source rocks are. Let's just define shale and things like that as the source rocks where the oil is generated, and it is leaked off into the conventional reservoirs. Gravity works. Oil floats up on water. The subsurface is full of water in the holes. Oil floats on the water up toward the surface and gets trapped in conventional fields. So where there's conventional oil that's been produced through time, there's going to be source rocks that are mature and generating. That's in the U.S., that's in the Middle East, that's in Russia, other places. So those source rocks that we are able to technologically produce from now have way more oil in them than the fields that trapped the leak off. And even Ghawar is a conventional field. I've been to the Middle East many, 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 many times, and into Saudi many, many, many times. And it's a wonderful giant field, conventional reservoir. But the source rocks that are charging it are even more extensive. And so, and then Russia, get ready, massive source rocks. So they haven't developed those yet, Chris, because they want to sell the conventional oil and gas that's easier to produce once you found it and gets them bigger margins. They want to sell that first. They would, in fact, prefer that the shale had never been found for a while. You can chase the dollar and see who was funding anti-hydraulic fracturing or fracking propaganda right back to Russia and the Middle East. It's not hard to chase the dollar and see that, and there's good business reasons to them for doing that. Let's just call that business. But you're right, it's more expensive, and the technology is much different to go into a shale with a vertical well, turn it horizontal, drill it laterally for 2 or 3 miles, stage it off and hydraulically fracture it, produce those fluids back. Very expensive, a very low margin business, more like a bond fund as opposed to a stock. You know, you might bet on one stock, and that's your, if you get one to hit, that's your nice conventional field, as opposed to investing in some bonds in your portfolio. Let's call that the shale. They don't make a lot of money, but most of them make a little bit of money or lose a little bit. It's the reason the majors are back into those systems now. So they're different, but the point is there's a lot of oil in place down there. So we'll call that the resource. The resource in the Bakken and the Eagle Ford and out in West Texas is vast, trillions of barrels. The reserves, technically recoverable, are much smaller because our technology is today, not tomorrow. And what's been produced is this little teeny piece of it. About 2% of the gas from shale in the U.S. so far has been produced, 2% of what's in place, and 1% of the oil. Now, we've done extensive, really detailed studies, geology, engineers, economists on these big shale fields. So this is something I understand well, and it's a very small percentage. It's tough to get another percent out, but if they're back to our conversation, if there's demand, the policy allows it, and the economics are close enough to positive, some will lose money, some will make money, then we'll continue to develop those source rocks in the U.S. And probably we'll start to see that happening globally as these conventional fields continue to decline.
Now, this is a fascinating topic, and I'm really glad to have you on for this piece, because this is something we investigate quite a lot. I look at this, I'm not a geologist, but I do a lot of financial analysis, and I've had my financial critiques of the shale industry. I mean, a simple thing, I think it's also subsidized. In your state of Texas, last year I have data for about $1.8 billion in severance taxes collected off the wells, and about $4 billion in road and bridge damage done by the trucks. Principally. So there's a little bit, if we look at the full cycle cost of these, I'm not sure we're there yet, but as well, the majority of the shale companies have been cash flow negative for a decade. Now, sure. the key piece I want to get to you, though, is recently the CEO of Schlumberger just last week, earnings call, said, hey, we're looking at a little bit of earnings pinch here because there are so many child wells going in around the parent wells, particularly in the Eagle Ford he was talking about, but also in the Permian. 70% of all wells going in are child wells, and he's noting they're already seeing interference parent to child. I'm not a geologist, but by the time I hear those words, Scott, I'm starting to think that that play has begun to... It's closer to the end than the beginning, in the sense of just being able to throw things, pipes down there willy-nilly and get a lot of stuff out of the ground. Now we're kind of starting to you know, we've been through the sweet spots because of the oil decline in price, all that. Where are you on that story? Is there a lot more to go?
Sure. Let me just say two things. One, it wasn't willy-nilly.
I know.
A lot of people have the technology to drill a horizontal well and 2 or 3 miles laterally, keep it in a 10-foot vertical window, frack it, and bring it back. It's like a lunar landing. It's remarkable.
Magic.
Now,
it is.
That said, we aren't even close to the technological understanding yet of the future. So if we were to stop technology, I would agree with your statement. We're probably in the mid-range or maybe on the decline. If that's number one, if we had produced half of the resource already, I would agree with you. We're probably, we've got what we can. About half is produced on the decline. The analogy, let's just step back in oil and gas terms. We can do it for any energy source. But let's go to oil. Conventional reservoirs, we used to struggle to get 10% out. And then along came what we called secondary recovery, putting water in and flooding some of the oil out. And tertiary recovery, thermal floods, CO2 floods, chemical floods, and getting another 10% out because the demand was there. So technology in shale is in its infancy, mm-hmm. even though we understand how to drill those wells. And yes, parent-child relationships are seeing some pressure drawdown. Now they're starting to putting them in multi-stories above one another, realizing they didn't drain the whole 300 vertical feet. Mm-hmm. And because there's this vast oil resource there, and we're only getting a couple percent out, again, if the demand is there, then some smart Schlumberger engineer is going to come along and say, hey, I know how to get another percent out of that. Let's try this. And And so you'll start to see 5, 6, maybe 10% recovery. That's not a lot, 10% out of 100, you know, leaving 90% behind. But 10% would be 10 times more than what we've done so far. So that, to me, is not a story in which we're in the backside of decline. We're actually still climbing. It will have fits and starts. And certainly, if something better comes along than oil for the globe, mostly for transportation, but used for so many other things as well, then maybe the technology focus isn't on that system. It goes to some new thing.
All right. So this gets us to the crux of the matter at this point, which is that I'm a huge fan of making this energy transition. In fact, I wish we were doing it faster. In fact, I'm nuts over the fact, Scott, that we're not doing things that seem brain dead simple to me. Like when you land in Tel Aviv or in China and you look out the window, you'll see solar thermal collectors to heat water up on every rooftop practically because they've mandated it. Because it makes sense because the sun heats stuff up. Great. Who knew? Right. So I love seeing that. I rarely see them in my own country when I'm landing in a city. So we don't really use them yet. I think there are lots of things we can and we should be doing. So I'm looking at an MIT study here. Some group there has calculated that at our current pace, the energy transition will be complete in, let me check the headline, 400 more years. Meaning we're going slow. Do you have any sense of urgency around? Like is that too slow?
Hey, I love solar thermal heating on the roof too. They have it in Greece. It just makes great sense, right?
Yeah.
Heat the water. Use it at night. If it's a cloudy day and you don't heat your water, then you use some backup something or other, electric or gas or whatever. So there are things like that that are wonderful and should be done. And they will be. You know, people kind of get the economics, and we've been a little spoiled by access to electricity and other systems in the developed economies. The transition is an interesting one. My transition means to where the world has energy, okay? My transition is not from one kind of energy to another. Mm-hmm. It's to where everybody has affordable, available, reliable, and environmentally sustainable energy, secure energy. That's a good transition. That introduces things into the world that allows for, again, the empowerment of women, immigration and migration to change in terms of why it's happening, not to mention education and all the basic things that the modern world enjoys and a third of the world doesn't. So that's an important transition to me, is to get access to the world for energy. The kinds of energy that are put in place to do that are going to vary by what the world has access to. Every place in the world has different energy resources. Again, some are blessed with great oil and gas. Some have uranium and thorium and nuclear that they can do. Some have wonderful wind. Some have terrific solar. There are places with wonderful tides and waves, and they can capture that economically. Geothermal in Iceland and Southeast Asia and other places. Again, we'll use what we have where we have it to accomplish the transition to a world where everyone has access to secure energy. The qualifying some energy as green and good and others as dirty and bad is hindering that progress. It's causing political division and policymakers to do things that they may or may not do otherwise in a logical, sort of technical, economic, scientific sense in order to meet the politics. And the challenge is, of course, this, and again, somebody might throw their second shoe, but the sun and the wind are renewable. The stuff to capture them is not. The turbines and the solar panels are not renewable. Mm-hmm. We have to mine for all those metals. We have to mine for the silica, the rare earth elements, the chemicals and metals to make the batteries, lots and lots of batteries to back them up, the wires to transmit the electrons where they need to be, and the landfill to dispose them as they wear out, because it's a low-density resource and it takes a tremendous amount of stuff to capture it. It wasn't concentrated by nature like oil and gas and coal were. So the challenge is, how do we make the energy systems of the world environmentally sustainable in global, you know, global atmosphere, CO2, methane, other greenhouse gases, local air emissions from combustion of things, land use for renewables, the mining, the manufacturing, the disposal, and all the backup systems, and water, which is used across many energy systems. Mm-hmm. How do you do it in a way that is much better than what we currently do, but also doesn't hinder the ultimate transition, which is secure energy to the world?
So, excellent points. And when I want to turn now in the time we have remaining to this idea of the future, and two things popped up. I can't wait to hear about thorium. I want to get to that next. First, storage, though. Storage is the one thing, Scott, that if somebody came along and had that little battery, you described the magic thing the size of my phone, my entire worldview changes in a heartbeat. I've been very anxiously looking out. I hear exciting things coming out of labs that they've got this incredible new, somebody, you know, came out with, we're going to use sodium. You know, he was the grandfather of some other battery type. And then somebody says, I got this flow battery. They all look good. What are you seeing in terms of storage? Where really are we and what can we look forward to?
Yeah. You know, when Switch came out in 2012, I used to go to places and do Q&As. I still give lots of talks. And when asked about that, you remember the graduate, and the one word was plastics. And
yeah.
my one word is storage. I think it flips things on its ear a bit if we could store energy well. Well, what does that mean, though? Let's define what storage means. It has to be affordable. Mm-hmm. It has to be reliable, and it has to be scalable. Now, those three things together are really tough, Chris. You could get scalable but not affordable. You could get affordable but not scalable or reliable. You know, maybe reliable, really beautiful little battery, but not scalable. And so none of those things impact things in the way they need to. That's a tough challenge. Chemical batteries, solid. We have a guy here at UT who invented the lithium-ion battery. He's in his 90s. He's in his second part of his career. He says he's working on solid-state batteries. You know, if we can get those kinds of batteries more efficient, again, mining and manufacturing is non-trivial. Go inside a battery manufacturing plant sometime and take a look around. I mean, Elon calls them gigafactories, but they're big chemical manufacturing plants. And so what does that look like? And where do we dispose all of these batteries when they wear out? I'm sure everybody takes it to the recycling facility, but at scale. And so it's not a trivial challenge there. How else do you store energy? Pumped hydro is a real simple way. You pump water uphill when you have a lot of excess energy, motion of wind or extra sun or other things, and flow it downhill through turbines when you need it. Same thing with compressed air storage. Wind up a flywheel, charge a capacitor. And capacitors are getting really neat with nano sheets and nanomaterials now. A lot of potential there. Hydrogen, you know, fuel cells is wonderful ways, instead of diesel, perhaps, as big backups to energy systems. Thermal, buildings in a different way, such that they store heat in the day and then release it at night if it's chilly. Just broad forms of energy efficiency. Using less to do more is another, I think, of concept of storage. If I can do the same amount of work, I use that in an energy term, but in an mm-hmm. economic term as well, with energy and using less to do it, I've saved energy and I can use that later. That's a storage, isn't it? mm-hmm. It's a different kind. But so I think there are neat things going on, but I don't want to trivialize the difficulty of affordable, reliable, and scalable in terms of storage and put our eggs all in that basket. Still, when I come home from a trip, if I get in a gasoline engine after 3 months, it's still there. The gasoline hasn't gone anywhere. All the energy's density is there. I start my car and drive away. That's an interesting form of energy storage that I wouldn't get with a battery. And so, you know, there's challenges to each of these things that I think we shouldn't trivialize in the name of simplification, oversimplification, or politics.
Well, thank you for that. And that very well said. And this is a point I've been trying to make a lot, because people will come and say, look at this amazing thing that Elon Musk has done with the Tesla cars, beginning with the Roadster on through. And before they get too far, I just say, please wander with me over to the big world of lithium mining and how much there is. Right. It's just a simple equation. Like, if you want to have this many vehicles on the road and you want to use that battery chemistry, we're going to need this much lithium. And all of a sudden, it becomes a very difficult story to really get to your three things: affordable, reliable, scalable. Scalable is the issue I have around that. And maybe affordability, too, when it comes to lithium. If you're looking at third world people who are looking at a buck a day, a Tesla is kind of out of reach. Even a, you know, a lithium battery of a small flashlight size is kind of pricey. So,
yeah, we drove a Roadster and Switch, and it's a beautiful motor. It's so much fun. But, you know, a Tesla S, the four-door sedan, has 7,100 lithium-ion batteries in it. And if I do 7,100 times 10% of the 1.2 billion vehicles currently in the world and growing, let's call it 120 million vehicles. So we're going to electrify 10% of them. You know, 10% of the world's vehicle fleet, 120 million times 7,000. Well, that's a lot of batteries.
It sounds like a lot. And there are those little beautiful Panasonic AA's. It's astonishing. I don't think people really realize that if you took a can opener and you opened it up, that's what you'd find. You could run a lot of flashlights on a Tesla car, but still brilliant. And I love that we're talking about re-electrifying vehicles now again in the early part of this century, and when we did it 100 years ago, too. In the time we have left, I got to ask, thorium. I've had Kirk Sorensen on a couple of times. He's the only person I've had, you know, really come on and actually mention the word. But when I've been in China and talking with people from India, they're both pursuing thorium. Where do you stand on that as a idea?
I like it. I'm not a nuclear physicist. But I think that thorium has, from what I know and understand, some advantages over uranium. We went uranium here in the U.S., as did the world. The byproducts of uranium include plutonium, which we, by the way, needed at the time for Cold War reasons. So I think that thorium has some big advantages, as I understand them, in terms of waste, managing the waste, handling the waste, efficiency, and availability of thorium. I would love to see India pursue a thorium nuclear component to their electric grid. It, you know, again, if your largest concern in the world is climate change, then the fastest way to get there that's scalable and affordable is nuclear fission. I'm not talking about fission, which exists today. And thorium and uranium both are critical to that process. So, you know, again, big economies that need to grow and industrialize need the electricity. Nuclear is a part of that solution. And you're seeing some interesting bedfellows now. I shared the stage with Stuart Brand a couple years back in the Northeast U.S. At a kind of a called Kent Presents, a TED-like thing for an hour. And you know, Stuart's a brilliant guy, done some wonderful work environmentally, the original environmentalist, the Whole Earth Catalog and Clock of the Long Now and these things. And we converged at the end. He's big on density, nuclear, GMOs for food, et cetera. We converged. I think people were a little disappointed. You know, the geologist from Texas and the environmentalist from California are actually agreeing. but there's a reason for that. And you see these different NGOs and governments and industries saying, yeah, nuclear, small modular reactors, more efficient ways to put the depleted, spent uranium away and that kind of thing. So I think we'll see it happen, but it's got some public resistance and perhaps just, how do I want to say that, lack of more recent and good information that could be shared with the public to let them understand that those kilowatt hours of nuclear power have been remarkably safe across the world. So
Yeah, Scott, I completely agree with that. And listen, I don't think we have enough data on the thorium fuel cycle to be certain, but what I know of it and how it's been explained to me, I say, well, this sounds better than the U-235 plutonium cycle to me. And, you know, it's a U-233 cycle. The actinides are much more short-lived. If it melts down, it cools rather than runs away from you. It's so from a safety aspect. Anyway, affordable, reliable, scalable, I can see a path with thorium in it. I'm just concerned that the United States just doesn't seem to have any interest in that as a technology, at least not on a public sphere, not at the government level. So I'm intrigued by that one at this point. But again, still looking at it with one eye half closed because I'm not totally sure yet. But I'd love to see what the data is and get some more work on that. And I certainly hope,
you know, it's a single global atmosphere. So if India can do that, that would be a wonderful contribution, like France has done to atmospheric reduction of emissions. And, you know, we do other things that are good. So everybody kind of does their part, but you don't try to create one formula for each economy.
Exactly. And for more on this, everybody, I'm looking at a website right now on my screen right here. It's switchenergyproject.com. There's a huge number of educational videos on there that start right at the beginning with such things as like, well, what's electricity? Progresses all the way up through each of the alternative options. You've got wind, hydro, biofuel, solar, geothermal, nuclear. It's all in there, really clear, very well produced, super high quality. Scott, how did you make all of those and what's behind those?
and let me direct you towards switchon.org now, because our new website has just come live.
Excellent.
And it's in a much more modern Netflix style where it's a customized user experience. You go in and you look at one and it directs you toward another one and it tracks your progress and lets you see what you're seeing. It's really fun. There are 300 of those. They're short format, 1 to 3 minute videos, primers, 101s, the Switch Energy Lab, me in a goofy white lab coat with goggles doing experiments. The Switch film itself, feature length and chapterized, subtitled in several languages. Did it out of passion. You know, Chris, really seriously, I think that nonpartisan, objective energy information isn't that easy to get, particularly in video form. We were awarded many awards by environmental film festivals, but the energy industry embraced it as well, and as have governments. So we're continuing to film. We're making movies right now, a big film on energy poverty. We'll add that content. But I really appreciate you pointing it out, because I think it's so important, particularly for students of all ages, but particularly students in universities and high schools, to get a balanced look at energy and understand at some level that there are solutions here, but the challenge, it's not just a black and white good and bad thing. It just isn't that way. It's not political will. It really is it's a complex set of dynamics that we're working on, and they will do, I'm confident, in the next generation, if they're given information that's reasonable to start from.
Well, excellent. So switchon.org, please check that out, people. And if you want to host a viewing of Switch, I assume that's possible and can be found at that website as well, Scott?
Absolutely, and it's free of charge.
Excellent.
We make it all free. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, if we're going to, you know, solve energy poverty, we shouldn't start with a poverty of information. So thank you for doing that work. It's really important work. I absolutely 100% agree with nonpartisan, non-denominational, just get the energy information out there. Big decisions have to be made, and there are no easy answers. It's down to decision time. So that's the fundamental cornerstone of democracy, I guess, a well-informed electorate understanding what the issues are. These are the most important issues, though. No energy, nothing else is possible. Full stop. So that's my view at any rate. And with that, everybody, we've been talking with Dr. Scott Tinker. Scott, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been wonderful, Chris. I appreciate your insights and willingness to engage. Thanks.
You're welcome.